We learn about treating parasitic worms and new breakthroughs at UW Oshkosh here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Schistosomiasis, a disease caused by parasitic worms. And according to the CDC, even though the worms that cause it are not found in the U.S., over 200 million people are infected worldwide. Join in on parasitic worms, signs, symptoms, treatments, 800-642-1234. John Chan is an assistant professor of chemistry at UW Oshkosh, where his research focuses on drug development for neglected infectious diseases. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Well, start us out with a bit of a tour of parasites. Help us understand the difference between what we may call swimmer's itch here in Wisconsin and then schistosomiasis that affects millions of people around the world.
Sure. So when you have swimmer's itch, you're getting affected essentially with a parasitic worm that wants to be inside ducks and things like that. But these worms have cousins that live in other countries, places like Africa, and those relatives of those worms, which are also schistosomes, those can cause human disease, but we don't have them here in Wisconsin.
So, and how do they work with the freshwater snails? These are parasites that cause the disease that live in freshwater snails?
Yep, exactly. So these worms, they need two animals to propagate their life cycle. So they cycle between snails and if you have the duck version, ducks, or the human version, humans.
And then, so how does that work with freshwater bodies of water? Because I think I learned that you can't get this in oceans, but you can in freshwater.
Yeah, so the key is where the snails are. Because those are the animals that are releasing sort of the baby worms, their technical word for it is cercaria, that are going to then be swimming in the water and penetrating the skin of either a person or a duck. And so if you're around where snails are, then you got a chance of getting swimmer's itch. Yep.
And this often happens then, or not often, I'm not sure how often, but in under or, less developed parts of the world, like Africa, places in South America?
Yeah, so in those countries, the snails harbor parasites that are able to infect and survive within humans. So in those countries, it is a real big problem. You read different papers that'll give you different numbers, but it's around 200 million people infected a year. So it's quite a common disease there and mostly affects children.
And the CDC says this disease is second only to malaria as the most devastating parasitic disease. What medical research do you think is lacking in this area?
Well, I think what a lot of it comes down to is, this affecting, more than 90% of cases are in sub-Saharan Africa. And it costs between $1 to $2 billion to develop a drug. So I think there's just not a real incentive for the pharmaceutical industry to do a lot of research and development for a drug that targets a disease that mostly affects poor people. And that's kind of the niche then that someone working in academia like me can work on a problem that is kind of unaddressed.
So what happens when it infects people? What does the worm do that causes this disease? What does that do inside of humans?
Yeah, so like we started out talking about swimmer's itch, the larval worm will penetrate the skin, and that will cause a little bit of a rash. And then a few weeks will go by, and the worm's going to take a couple months to mature into adults. During that time, you might experience a fever or something like that. But the bad part of the disease comes whenever the worms mature into adults, and they're able to lay eggs, which then can get caught up inside of the person's organs. So for example, some of the countries that have a lot high incidence of schistosomiasis in Africa, they have very high rates of bladder cancer because eggs are carcinogens. And they also get caught up in the liver and other organs. And that's where a lot of the nasty parts of the disease actually come from, is the eggs. Because a single male and female worm that are mating can lay hundreds to thousands of eggs a day. And these worms can live for I mean, typically they probably only live for several years, but there's cases out there that finding worms in people that have had infections going on 30 plus years. So that's the real bad part.
So would they mostly live in the intestine? Would they live elsewhere in our organs?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the species, the exact species. They might live at different places. It kind of breaks down roughly 50-50 between species that want to live around the blood, the vasculature around the bladder, mm-hmm. and about 50-50 with ones that are in the vasculature around the intestines, yeah.
We are talking about the larger implications of schistosomiasis disease with John Chan, also in relation to swimmer's itch and what he sees there. He's an assistant professor of chemistry at UW Oshkosh, researching drug development for neglected infectious diseases, and in the process of developing a second drug to treat schistosomiasis. You can join in with questions about parasitic disease and treatment, 800-642-1234. Looking more at what we call swimmer's itch here, John, why is swimmer's itch prevalent during Wisconsin's early summer?
Yeah, so when you think about where that swimmer's itch is coming from, you just got to consider the snails. So whenever we have conditions that the snails are breeding and growing, that's whenever the parasites the snails harbor are going to be released. So when the water gets warmer, there's an increase in the vegetation in the shoreline where they like to sort of breed. Then you're going to have those populations growing, then they're going to release their parasites. And if you're by the shore swimming, then you know they might accidentally get in you.
How can swimmers avoid swimmer's itch? Are there any preventative measures?
It's not great. Some people use like a waterproof sunscreen or something like that to create a bit of a barrier, because those worms are trying to get into your skin, right? So if you have a little bit of a barrier there, that might be helpful. But yeah, the Wisconsin DNR website says that in a typical like 100 square feet, you could have 30 million of these parasite larvae because the snails can release thousands of these worms per day. So yeah, if you're in an area that's known to have it, maybe a better route would just be not to be swimming by the shoreline where you see like the vegetation in places where the snails could be.
Mm-hmm. A bit of more yuck factor here, but how does people, if people are going to the bathroom in the water, how would that affect the cycle and the spread of parasites at all? What is the interaction there?
Yeah, and that's one of the big reasons why this disease is a problem in sub-Saharan Africa, right? Is because sort of the infrastructure for hygiene and things might be the greatest, and there's an education component of it too. Because like I was saying, these worms, they lay these eggs inside the people around their intestines or their bladder. Well, to propagate that life cycle, those eggs have to get out and to get into the water to infect snails again. And that happens through pee and poop. So if people have an option to use latrines and things like that rather than going to the bathroom in a water source that's going to propagate that life cycle, it would reduce, I think, some of the incidents.
We have UW Oshkosh chemist John Chan with us, working on drug development to treat parasitic flatworms that cause disease in people and animals. We haven't talked about animals. Join in on swimmer's itch, as it's called, contaminated water, neglected tropical diseases you want to talk about, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John Chan here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about parasites that can penetrate the skin of people who are wading, swimming, bathing, washing in contaminated water, like some lakes and rivers in Africa, parts of South America. We're discussing how to prevent and treat schistosomiasis and the research connection at UW Oshkosh on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Join in with questions on the potential for contaminated water overseas, the snails required to maintain the parasite's life cycle? 800-642-1234. Chemist John Chan and his lab at UW Oshkosh developing a drug to treat the parasitic disease, and with us for about 9 more minutes. So, John, currently the recommended drug on the market is praziquantel. Is that right? How does that work?
Yep, you're saying that right. So this is a drug that it works pretty well. It works
what was used?
70 to 90% of the population. So it's quite effective, but the concern is then with just one drug on the market.
There's
the potential for the emergence of resistance. So this drug, a target has been proposed within the last year or two, but it's also not really very thoroughly understood how it kills parasites.
So if I understand, then you're working on a different drug, a separate treatment. Is that right?
Yep, exactly.
And then what happens if the primary treatment, doesn't work anymore, or the primary drug that people have been using for decades starts to wane and not be as effective?
Yeah, so that's the real concern. I mean, there's efforts underway funded by like Bill Gates Foundation and things like that to give praziquantel to everyone who needs it in sub-Saharan Africa, which is great. But if you start to give this drug, the concern is that there will start to be emergence of resistance and it might not work as well. And then there wouldn't really be a backup. So yeah, that's why there needs to be a second drug. And like I said, this is also a drug that works against 70 to 90% of the cases. You know, multiply that by 200 million and you can make an argument that even right now there's people that probably wouldn't wish there was a second drug on the market.
Sounds like there should be a vaccine for this, perhaps. Or is there a vaccine possible in the works?
Yeah, a lot of people have been working on that for a real long time. I think that, and the short answer is that there isn't one. I think the part of the reason for that is that these worms, they live in blood. That's how they've evolved, is to live, you know, inside an environment constantly surrounded by the immune system. So they've become very good at escaping and hiding from our immune systems, which might be part of what complicates the efforts to develop vaccines. But yeah, short answer is that would be great, but not one at the moment.
Well, let's take a call now. Lynn is joining us from Union Grove. Hi, Lynn. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to let you know, we had a cabin up in Crivets, and we used to swim in the lake, and we would have our kids and ourselves wash off afterwards, and we never got swimmer's itch.
Okay, Lynn, you were breaking up just a little bit, but if I understand correctly, John Chan, Lynn said that they used to always, wash off with soap after swimming, and that really, they never got swimmer's itch.
Yeah, that's good to do. I mean, because the Cercaria, the parasites, they might be on your skin, but not have yet managed to penetrate it. And if that's the case, then it's good that you could remove them by washing immediately after you get out of the water. Yep.
What is your path to getting your drug treatment to market? Where are you at? What steps?
Yeah, so right now we have, I'm working with a chemist group in UW-Milwaukee, and we have a compound that works pretty well. And once that gets patented, the next step would be to move that into larger animals. It works in mice, but then, a lot of things work in mice that don't work in people. So then you got to move it up to bigger, like dogs and things like that. Mm-hmm. So but for that work, we'll probably want to sort of pass the baton to a pharmaceutical company, eventually have them license it and do that. Cause that's not really, that's not work that I do. That's not, at a small school like UWO, the kind of, because like I said, it costs $1 to $2 billion to develop a drug, right? So that would kind of be licensed off to a pharma company that would be interested.
You mentioned dogs, which brings me to wondering about pets. Are they susceptible to this disease?
So not this specific
schistosomiasis. Yeah, no.
But the reason why that's worth mentioning is because that's probably the context that many of us think about parasitic worms here, where we're not affected by it. But do you have a dog or a cat?
I have a cat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, my dogs have to deworm them quite regularly. Otherwise, you know, you can get any number of things, tapeworms, heartworm, things like that. And resistance to those drugs is also a real problem. So ideally, you know, there's the drug that we develop is going to be broad spectrum. Tapeworms are related to this type of these schistosomes that we're talking about. They're within the same fat phylum. So certainly the hope would be that there's this broader market. And, you know, like I was saying, there's not a ton of money for treating a drug in the third world. So from the money perspective, it also there's more money for veterinary applications here in the U.S. Yeah.
Do animals receive praziquantel for any reason?
Yep.
Do they? Yeah. Okay.
So the tapeworms, like I mentioned, that's usually in like the chicken flavored syringe that you give. So like when I had a dog, I'd have to, you go to the vet, they give you the syringe of the chicken flavored goop, which has a cocktail of different drugs. One of the three is praziquantel. Yeah.
That's very scientific. I like the goop. Yes, very scientific there. Talking about the treatment and development of drugs to treat neglected tropical diseases with UW Oshkosh Assistant Professor of Chemistry John Chan. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John, what about chlorinated pools? What about swimming in those? Can there be a spread of this schistosomiasis in chlorine pools?
You're probably fine there because if the snails aren't there, then you're going to be good.
Okay. All right. So it really is dependent on that life cycle with that snail being front and center. You got to be there.
Yep, exactly.
What other neglected tropical diseases should people pay attention to? I mean, you talk about pets and deworming, but what are we missing out there with neglected infectious diseases?
Yeah, I mean, so well, you mentioned malaria being a big one. There's news recently on a new vaccine that's very promising. But yeah, these are the big broad family of diseases, many of which are caused by worms. So worms that maybe live in your GI tract, things like Ascaris, hookworm, things like that. Not really a huge concern here in this country where we have a good hygiene. But in the past they were, yeah.
So with the drug that you're developing, how does it exactly then treat or eliminate the disease? How does it attack it?
Yeah, so that's not super well understood. This drug is actually, if you ever heard of like Valium and drugs like that,
mm-hmm.
It's related to those. And for some reason, you know, in the 70s, a drug company tested an older member of this class against these parasites, and it did work, but the problem was that it put everyone to sleep as well, and so it was just the development stopped because that would be an unacceptable side effect. And where we kind of picked up was that we found that we could remove those sedative side effects and have it still kill parasites without putting people to sleep, or at least mice in our case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now the goal would be to move to larger animals in order to do additional testing.
Yep, exactly.
As we wrap up, we only have a minute left here. What is the toughest challenge as you do this research? What do you grapple with?
Money, keeping the doors open. That's always, you know, if the money stops, then you can't pay to do the work. So that's a big part of most scientists day to day.
Is writing those grants, keeping those grants, because in order to keep the grants, those grants are I would imagine, help paying for the people who, the students also in the lab, as well as the equipment and things like that.
For sure. I mean, whenever I became a professor, I felt like I stopped being a scientist and I became an author because it is a huge part of the day. Yeah.
Is it becoming more competitive to hang on to these grants and get these grant awards?
Yeah, I guess I think of them like lottery scratch tickets. You know, maybe a low percentage for any individual one, but just write a lot and it'll work out. That's the hope anyway.
John, good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Yep, thanks, Kate.
John Chan, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at UW-Oshkosh, where his lab is in the process of patenting a drug to treat schistosomiasis. We have a link to his work and the lab at wpr.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, landfills in America can take years to get approval and are often fraught with controversy, like over NIMBY, not in my backyard. Join in with questions about landfill design, where your garbage goes, innovations in this area, 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about landfill practices of the future on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. So earlier this month, the Madison Common Council voted in favor of selling a part of the Yahara Hills Golf Course to make room for more landfill. City and county leaders estimate the current one will be full by 2030, and Dane County Board signed off last week on the $5.5 million plan to buy a portion of the golf course from the city, telling the State Journal that this isn't the final vote, though. So join in on landfill space, location, how they're built, 800-642-1234. James Tingem is a UW-Madison professor of civil and environmental engineering, directs the College of Engineering's Geological Engineering Program. James, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Always good to be here.
Good morning. So as you watch what's unfolding in Dane County, are existing landfills reaching capacity around Wisconsin? What is the situation like?
Yes, they're always reaching capacity. In Wisconsin, the entire of the state, we probably have about 4 years of capacity. If you look at what's coming into all of our landfills versus what the permitted capacity is. So across the state, there are, you know, probably a handful to a dozen of expansions always in process to get that capacity for the state.
This is pretty basic, but what happens to garbage in a landfill? Because I have in my mind that the image of garbage breaking down eventually, but landfills are about burying the trash. Is that right?
Yeah. So what happens is there's typically a recycling process, both on your municipal waste, that will take out the plastics and cardboard and saleable paper. And then there's also a corresponding recycling process with construction and demolition debris so that we take out that usable wood and concrete and similar. So there's always a process of what's getting into our landfills for final disposal. That's going in there, and gas is being generated because of anaerobic decomposition of that waste. We're collecting that that gas, and we're either burning it for electricity, or in many sites, we're converting that to what we call high BTU gas for injection into the natural gas pipeline.
Oh, so what you're saying, I think, you know, the food scraps and the other food waste being, you know, a huge contributor to the volume of landfills. So if that landfill has all that organic material, that also creates energy.
It does, but we actually prefer that organic load, that food waste and similar, be diverted from the landfills and used in composting or others, because that decomposes so fast, we might get what we call fugitive gas emissions before we can collect it. So organic diversion is one of the things that we're discussing so that we don't overload our existing landfills.
What is the threat of landfill gases from all that organic material being in there that really shouldn't be in there? Because you've got the methane emissions and the carbon dioxide. How big of an issue is that?
Well, it is a big issue, not only because of nuisance odors around many landfills at times, but also because that's a valuable resource and otherwise a greenhouse gas emission. In the United States, landfills are about the third largest releasers of greenhouse gas emissions outside of fuel combustion for our vehicles and our electrical use. So that natural human contributions, landfills are a contributor. So we do our best to contain that and beneficially recover that gas.
And people don't want to live around landfills. I mean, we've been hearing residents and property owners really pushing back on the expansion of the landfill in Dane County, and officials from McFarland School District say they weren't consulted. What is the process for gathering public input when a landfill project is expanding?
Yes, so it is a very long process. It's typically 5 to 7 years for what we call a new greenfield site or a landfill that's placed on a property that has not had waste before. The public will have quite a bit of input into that. There are three parts of that 5 to 7 year process. There is the Department of Natural Resources review process. There is the local review and negotiation with the local communities, and then there's always that public process. So I guess there's three kicks of the can per se out there over this very long process as we evaluate the suitability and feasibility of siting a new landfill.
So if it does take 10, 15, maybe more years to expand or create a new landfill, I would imagine that designers like you really have to take that to heart, because it is a very long process that you can't just flip a switch overnight.
That is correct. We're probably thinking 10, 15 years out of what happens next, looking at what the disposal rights are coming to your individual landfill, how much capacity you have left, how long this review and approval process is going to be. And, you know, landfills are businesses. It's either a public business, a public enterprise fund, or it's a private business. And, you know, businesses strive for certainty, so we know what's coming, what to expect, and similar. So, yes, it's a long-term planning process.
James Tingem with us, CW Madison Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, as we talk about landfills, the future of waste management here in Wisconsin, and how landfills are designed for the future. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. James, historically, landfills or hazardous waste sites, they have been placed in or around poor non-white neighborhoods. What safeguards are in place to stop this pattern from continuing to happen?
Yes, very good question. That social justice, you know, we really need to look at siting our landfills that is closest to population base, so that, you know, if you have a high population base such as Milwaukee or Madison, you are not hauling that trash out, say, 50, 70 miles away into a rural community. That does not seem equitable to me. And also because disadvantaged communities don't generally have the resources to develop a public relations campaign and a web page and hire lawyers to fight, that, you know, we just need to consider that ultimately the best place for a landfill is because it's close to where we're disposing of the waste, it's close to natural gas lines, and it is close to the community that it's being served.
When you talk about those natural gas lines, how often are Wisconsin landfills able to convert the methane gas into this high-value natural gas?
So most landfills are at least minimally doing gas to energy projects, which means that they are collecting the methane and burning it for electricity. However, over the last 5 to 7 years, the price for solar and wind energy has dropped so much that basically utilities don't need to go to landfills anymore to purchase that electricity, because there's other competing sources. So a couple of landfills that are large enough and have the capacity and source next to the natural gas line will do what we call that high BTU conversion, where we strip out the volatiles, the hydrogen sulfide, the carbon dioxide, the nitrogen. We'll remove that so that we can inject that methane as natural gas straight to the pipeline. And there's lots of credits, transportation credits and similar, that are really high value because we're otherwise displacing other transportation fuels and similar. So if you can, the value in that gas is very high if we can get it into a natural gas pipeline.
It sounds like the infrastructure, though, is key. It's got to get right there into the pipeline, or else, there are other competing interests for that energy.
Yeah, so that interconnect is over $1 million, possibly $2 million to get that interconnect into the natural gas line. And then you're probably talking about $1 million per mile to install a natural gas pipeline. You know, so if your pipeline is, say, 15 miles away, you know, all of a sudden the economics are not looking quite as rosy.
I want to talk a little here about leachate, because you build these modern landfills with that plastic lining to contain leachate. How do you ensure that there aren't any rips in the liner, or that there is leaking and leaching from the landfill?
Very good question. And now you're in my technical wheelhouse. I'll try to explain this in the best that I can. Is what we have is a composite liner in Wisconsin and across the United States. That means it's a 4 foot of low permeability compacted clay topped with a thin geomembrane made of high density polyethylene that should be impermeable to flow. However, we do expect about one or two defects or holes per acre. And often what we'll do is we'll do, in the construction process, we'll do geophysical surveys that we can identify those defects and repair them. We're actually getting pretty good at that. And so I think of it this way. I think of it as the liner system is a Reese's peanut butter cup. With the Reese's peanut butter cup, chocolate is good. The peanut butter is good. Put them together, it's really good. Same thing with a liner. Put the plastic with compacted clay. It's really, really good and very effective.
Oh, thank you so much for that image. As we talk about Wisconsin landfills and waste management design, how landfills are changing, how they work, UW-Madison professor James Tingem teaches landfill design and management. Join in on landfill expansion, what your community is considering, questions you have about where your garbage goes, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with James Tingem here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin's solid waste management program has been in place for more than 40 years. The DNR's Waste and Materials Management Program has a working group, meets regularly to receive input, to find solutions for waste. We're talking about landfill management practices of the future here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Join in on your community's landfill. Questions do you have about how to address garbage building up? 800-642-1234. UW-Madison Engineering Professor James Tingem stays with us. Let's bring on a caller. Kevin is here from Janesville. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I was curious. Back to the landfill and the methane production and converting to natural gas, instead of shipping that into a pipeline, say, miles away, why not build a filling station for those vehicles that use automotive natural gas? That way you cut down infrastructure and cost and maybe turn a profit for those vehicles that burn that fuel. Thanks.
Kevin, thank you for that idea. James, what do you make of it?
That is great, and that is also being done at many sites. We call that as bio-CNG or bio-compressed natural gas, and that is used to run quite a few vehicles, for example, at the Dane County Rotifeld landfill. The issue is that we're just finding higher value financially in the conversion to the natural gas pipeline because of the credits that are out there. So bio-CNG is good, and that's being done. But just financially, at this point in time, it's just more financially viable to put it into a natural gas pipeline because of the credits that are received.
Along the lines of financial and financing solutions to landfills, several counties in the Fox Valley are sharing landfills, Brown, Outagamie, and Winnebago. They have reportedly saved $48 million through their 17-year agreement. Is this pretty common for a multi-government approach like this to landfills?
I would say that's pretty rare. I know that Brown County is up in that rotation, and they are working on a landfill right now. So it's pretty unique that you get three different county municipality or county governments together to work out a relationship such as this. But it's a good enterprise. You know, otherwise there's going to be a private company that's probably going to take on that role if municipalities or counties don't step up and do this.
There's a whole industry, I would imagine, for private companies to do this. Are there barriers to that, or are you able to see in engineering and innovation through private industry working for, with all of these public outfits and, cities and counties?
Yeah, so an interesting perspective I hope I'm going to convey here is that when you're a public entity, you are directly responsible for the public good. So you're more than likely going to be funding recycling centers, hazardous waste drop-off centers, things like that, that otherwise are an expense that a private company may not do. Not saying that the private companies aren't good, but when you're in the public, you're often raising funds to do other things in waste management that are good for the environment, good at keeping things out of the landfills and similar. That is not always, is more of an expense that public institutions are more likely to take on.
I looked at that pie chart from the EPA showing that nearly half of the waste produced in our country is disposed of directly in landfills. The other half is this combination of recycling and composting, as you talked about, burning, managing in all these different ways. Do you think, are we becoming too dependent on landfills for our garbage, or are you seeing diversification in how we handle it?
So there is diversification, however, in Wisconsin, every person is responsible for about 1.43 tons of waste that gets to our landfills every year, or about 7.84 pounds per day. So there's still quite a bit of waste that's getting to the landfills. So what we really need to look at is just continuing to look at those recycling streams, how we can pull off things like mattresses, or recycle appliances or resell furniture before it ever gets to the landfill. Municipal solid waste, it's still occurring. Every person in the state is responsible for a significant amount. Until we figure out how to divert more of that, we still need landfills to safely manage that waste.
Can we just say that over again? More than 7 pounds per Wisconsinite per day?
Yeah, if you look at every pound of waste that goes into a Wisconsin landfill, and then you look at the census, that equals 7.84 pounds per day for each person in the state, waste is going to a Wisconsin landfill.
Over time, over decades, is that poundage going up or
down? That's what it was in 2021, okay. And that's relatively consistent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's been happening over decades.
Wow. James Tingem with us, UW-Madison Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering. As we look at the future of landfills, how they're designed, how they work, you can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. James, what about trucking that garbage across state lines? Because Wisconsin both exports and imports garbage, I understand. Why are locally operated landfills accepting waste from out of state?
Yeah, so about a million cubic yards are coming into the state from Illinois and Minnesota primarily. And that's because of economics, the drive distance and similar. Some of Wisconsin waste is also going the other way. I can't say if it's a net balance, but so, you know, about 1 million cubic yards out of, I don't have the number in front of me right now, but it's a relatively small percent, less than 10%. And there is some flow going out. And that's really because of the farther you have to drive waste, the more expensive because of diesel and also all of those emissions that come with driving a heavy load.
What are the economics there of trucking garbage farther and farther? I mean, you know, from Illinois, I would imagine if it's just directly across the border, it's not as a big deal. But if you're talking about, you know, trucking garbage from the Chicago area, that would be a much longer distance.
Yes. Yeah, so a garbage truck is about 16 cubic yards, and then a transfer truck is about 40 to 60 cubic yards. So when we're doing that, we're loading it into bigger trucks so that we get better tons per gallon of diesel transported. Once you get past, it really depends on the price of diesel. So with diesel at over $5 a gallon right now, those economics really dictate how far you can drive that. If you're driving garbage more than, say, 40, 50 miles, that does not seem economically viable. It's definitely not sustainable as far as the environmental metrics.
We have less than a minute left, but how should people be thinking about the way they dispose of their garbage?
Well, you don't have to be like me. I have an illness. When I travel, I go visit the local landfills and get tours. I was just out in Seattle for one. But I just think that conscious decisions, that what you put in the garbage versus in your compost bin versus what you take to Goodwill, all of those individual decisions add up and they matter. So just a conscious decision that what you put in your garbage, even though part of it might end up back on your stovetop as natural gas, some of it will stay in that landfill. So just consciousness of what we're doing as an individual and as a society.
James, thank you for joining us.
It's great. Always great to talk trash. Thanks.
Thank you. James Tingem, UW-Madison Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, Director of the College of Engineering's Geological Engineering Program. Just ahead, we learn about the UW-Milwaukee Buildings, Landscapes, Cultures Field School, how it's training architects to nurture community projects around Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.